motion pictures. Imagine a world with no beauty in it. All I see is the negative, undeveloped negatives. Nothing worth framing in my frame of mind. It's like an empty gallery with white painted walls. All the flaws are hidden. I just want to adjust my focus.
What's up, family? I want to welcome you to another episode of the Hakimian Show. And today we are going to be talking about those issues that we are thinking about. And of course, those issues that all of us are going through. Let me make sure this audio is on and operating. All right. Yes, it is. And so today I'm excited about having a wonderful guest team that we're going to be community leaders. We're going to be talking about these issues. And our prayer is that this show would inspire you, would encourage you, would just help you in your life and whatever you're going through. And I believe it's going to be relevant as we discuss these issues. And of course, that was Propaganda from Humble Beast playing in the background. And we're going to be playing some of his music today to introduce you. If you have not heard Propaganda, he's an amazing artist. And he's doing powerful things. And that whole group, Humble Beast, is doing powerful things. So let me go ahead and introduce my team that's here with me today live. Let me go ahead and just switch off here. Vincent, how you doing today, brother?
What's going on, Jack? Good to be here. Things are well. Things are well. Really excited about ministry and just kind of where we're at in ministry and working in the community. Things are good overall. Things are good overall. Just busy. Busy just forecasting, planning for the holidays already. Looking forward to making an impact in people's lives and see how we can serve our community better.
Okay, good, good. Yeah. All right, so we got Pastor Reese. How are you doing today, Pastor Reese?
I'm doing good. Just came off our 20 years of pastoring. Me and my wife just had our anniversary, and it was an awesome time. I thank God for what we've been doing and accomplishing in the community where we're at, and looking for God to do more and for us to do more and be more creative and working in our community and helping people realize that you do have a place of refuge you can come.
Okay, good. All right, so we also got today marriage and family therapist and a good brother in the Lord, Kevin Gibson. How you doing, Kevin?
I'm good, man. I'm excited to be here again.
Okay.
Just a wonderful week, busy week. I'm just excited to be here.
Good, man. Well, let me just go ahead and dive into the first topic, man. A lot of people that are watching the show, and I know me personally from my own life, going through difficulties. Dreams that they want accomplished, things that they want to do. And there's real struggle, man. Struggle within themselves, struggle financially, struggle with their bodies, struggle in relationships. And I got a little clip I'm going to show. Pastor Vincent had shared with me where T.D. Jakes is very vulnerable and very transparent about his struggles and how when he started his ministry, it was a struggle. But man, just as we keep it real, how are you guys coping with some of the struggles that you're going through in your life right now?
Yeah, for me, I think first and foremost is being honest with it. Mm-hmm. I think what I love most about that clip that we're gonna take a look at is the willingness to admit, man, I wanted to quit.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just having room to express that kind of feeling, just where we're at. I know we wear the shield as leaders in whatever capacity that mm-hmm. we're in, and no one knows kind of the turmoil that we have, when we close the door, the yeah. doubt, the self-doubt, yeah. Did I say this? Is this gonna work? Is it not gonna work? So for me, I think, first step is just being vulnerable and being honest with where we're at and being able to share that with someone else. It'd have been interesting to find that kind of how he had disclosed that information in the midst of it.
Yeah.
Hindsight, of course, yeah, I can, now that I've worked through and I processed through my emotions, I can be a little bit more candid. But in the midst of it, kind of what do you do? You know what I mean?
Yeah. How about you, mm-hmm. Pastor Reese?
I a lot of times me is frustration because I have a willingness to do ministry. I have a willingness to be there and do the things I do in ministry, But, you know, you only have certain amount of people that want to help, that want to get involved. And I think that's the biggest thing, because now we have in ministry, I mean, when I was younger, when they say, hey, let's go and minister to people, you know, people used to run and jump ready to do it.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, well, I got this to do, I got that to do. So now it makes it difficult now. In churches and not just in my church, but in a lot of churches, to get people to do the thing. You have those faithful few that you know you can count on that's going to come and do what needs to get done. But then, you know, you have others that could be doing more, and they'd rather just sit there and do nothing, just come to church, hear a word, and go home. That's it. So, you know, that's frustrating when you tell people it's not just sitting in the church, hearing the word, and then you go home after that, you know, but introducing Christ to somebody else other than you, you know. And my old bishop used to always say, you know, we can't just feed the house. You got to feed the people outside the house too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're not doing that, then what are we doing, you know, far as ministry?
Yeah. So. Yeah. How about you, Kevin?
I think for me, man, is, you know, because it's in our nature as men to want to solve things on our own.
Right? Yeah.
And to just go out and fix things, right? But I think, Vincent, you made a very salient point to say, listen, you have to admit it. Yeah. You have to admit, like, okay, I'm struggling in this area. So for me, I think my issue would be just trying not to do it on my own.
Mm.
You know, because, you know, you have God gives us, you know, different brothers and fathers to be able to help you in those areas where, you know, you're struggling. So I think allowing pride to get in the way.
Right.
You know, because you're like, oh, I can do it on my own. I can deal with it.
Right.
On my own. But I think that's just for me. My issue would be just like, you know, hey, it's OK to ask for help.
Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Well, let me go ahead and just show this video here. And again, I think it's a real inspiring video, but it's real, you know.
I almost quit.
You almost quit.
I'm a country boy. I'm from West Virginia. I don't know nothing about this big time stuff. I never even asked to be big. I wanted to be effective, not famous. Famous is the consequences of being effective. I didn't know nothing about being famous, and I didn't like it. And so there I was. And when you first knew, everybody attacks you first and figures you out later. And the first time I was in the Washington Post, the article was so vicious it made me nauseous. I was so shocked that you could say that stuff about somebody you didn't even know based on assumptions and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They piece it all together and you don't get the same thing back. So I decided I don't want this. I was preaching for Pastor Bishop Donnie Mears, and nobody knew it because preachers can override their feelings and function. I preached, the place was on fire, but inside I wanted to quit. I told God that I'm through with this. I'm not going through this. I don't need this. I don't need that. I'm a guy who likes to go get his own chicken wings. I don't have to have all of that stuff to be happy. So I said, I'm not doing this no more. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this because I don't need this and I didn't ask for this. I'm only doing this because of what happened in my life, of the circumstances that happened in my life. He put me on stage. I didn't ask for it. And when I saw how much it cost, I thought, you can have that right back here. You can have that right back up in here. I don't need it. So I was mad inside, and I was hurt. And I stayed up in the fellowship with the pastors because I didn't want to go back to my room and sulk in my own sorrows. And they said, there's a lady downstairs waiting to see you. The service was over, and the fellowship was over. The pastor started to leave. I was trying to outwait her. I thought she'd give up and leave. And when I finally came down the steps, she was there. And she was just a willowy bit of a woman. And she said, Bishop Jakes, she said, I've been in the hospital. She said, I was pregnant in my fallopian tubes, and the baby died in my tubes, and I was carrying around a dead baby, and the toxicity from the baby almost killed me. And she said, the only thing that kept me alive was hearing you preach. She said, if you hadn't have been preaching to me every day, I swear I would have died. And then she looked at me and she said, it's for us. It's not for them. It's for us. It hit me so hard. I didn't even get her name. I got in the car and cried all the way back to my room, because she reminded me why I was there. Last week when I text you, I was up in Baltimore in DC, and I was doing a book signing, and this woman came up to the table to buy sword. She said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no. She didn't even look like the same person. She's all dressed up and gained weight. She felt like she wanted to say, wow. She said, I met you in the bottom of Donnie Mears Church years ago, and I burst into tears. I lost it. I stopped the signing, and I jumped up and hugged her. If it were not for that woman.
All right. So what do you guys think about this video?
Yeah, I think that's like the manna that God gives us, right? Mm. And manna by that, you know, we know the children of Israel, they're out in the wilderness, they're crying for something to eat and want to go back to Egypt because they're used to that. But yeah. Then God sends this substance, no one knows actually what it is, but it's enough to sustain them and it fills them, right? And I think for us, God sends manna for us even in our moment of despair, and our moment of wanting to give up. Someone that again reminds us why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Someone that encourages us that even though we are going through that kind of, you know, that place that's difficult, but it gives perspective on who's actually kind of, you know, it gives perspective on why we do it.
Yeah.
You know, and it helps us cope with those moments a little bit better. I know God has really blessed me on a couple of times. Those moments where I just felt discouraged. You know, as preachers, we'll preach a message and you'd be like, man, I don't know what I just said, but we'll see. And then someone will just come to you and be like, man, Pastor, you know, what a great word that encouraged me. And I was like, oh, wow, praise the Lord. That was a word in there for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of picks us back up, and then God reminds us that it's not us. And last thing, Jack, you put a post up on Facebook, I believe it was today,
uh-huh.
And you said something from the Holy Spirit, said, it's not yours, Jack. Get up and do with it what I've called for you to do.
Yeah.
Right. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And just being committed to that which God has said to us. And trying to find some encouragement in that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just want to say, on top of that, you know, a lot of times as a pastor, you do get discouraged. You do think nobody's really listening to what you're saying. And, yeah, I mean, even just this morning, I got a young lady that just called me out of the blue. Her and her family moved to Jacksonville. And she was talking to me, and she said, Pastor Reese, she said, you know, she said, I've tried to go to like 3 different churches up here. And she says, there's no church I've been to like the one I was when I was at FLE. And she said, you and your wife are just so genuinely. And she said, and far as teaching the word and just everything, working with me and my family. And
yeah.
And a lot of times that make you feel like, you know what? This is all worth it, you know, because if I could just, you know, get one person, but just for a mother to say, hey, it's affecting my children, it's affecting my husband, it's showing us how to, you know, live according to the word of God, and not to, you know, down anybody else's church, but, you know, it's to say that, you know, all the preaching, all the teaching is not in vain. You know, there is somebody that is listening and watching to see how we react and see how we handle adversity. And if the pastors don't can't handle the adversity, how do you expect somebody else to handle the adversity? You know, so I really think that, you know, we are totally different in some ways far as pastors and leaders, according to people, you know. We're set at a higher standard.
Yeah.
That we don't have issues. We don't have problems. You know, oh, pastor, all right, he got it going on. Mm-hmm. But people don't understand. We do have issues. We're human beings just like you. We go through things just like you. We have mechanical difficulties just like anybody else. But it's good when you have a person can give you an encouraging word to say,
yeah,
pastor, you know, we know that you're, you know, even though you're going through, you still standing, you still holding on, you know. And a lot of people, a lot of pastors need to hear that from their, you know, from their members, from their church, that they are doing what they're supposed to do.
I think when God calls you to do something, he not only prepares you for it, but he sustains you for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think with him being able to sustain us, and whether it's in ministry or even in our vocation,
yeah,
he will allow some certain times where we not only depend on our own strength,
mm-hmm,
but he'll allow us to get weak where we can't depend on anybody but him.
Yeah,
you get what it. I'm saying? And so, yeah, he has to remind you, yeah, like, you didn't choose this. I chose this,
right,
for you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So even in your vulnerability and your weak point,
mm-hmm,
I'm going to let you know that you're effective, not in your own merits, but mm-hmm, me being able to give you the strength to endure,
yeah,
it. So I think that's really what I truly gain from that. And it's truly an encouragement. Because even sometimes I'll be sitting in a session and I'm like, yo, I'm tired, or I'm not feeling it. And, yeah, then they'll say, you told me this last week, man. And that just really blessed, yeah, you know, that blessed me. And so, yeah, them being able to say that encourages me, yeah, in, yeah, that very moment.
Right.
So I think, right, God allows that to happen for us to say, you know what? He's right, going to keep us to keep on.
Yeah. Right.
Gives us that stick-to-itness.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder, you know, what's that kind of balance between, you know, our perception of things and kind of God's perception, right? Because when we're looking at it through human eyes, there are certain things that we see that then for us means that this wasn't effective.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, God is saying, no, there's another work that you don't see or that you're not even trying to see right now because you're so busy caught up in your own situation,
mm-hmm,
that I'm working something out, mm-hmm, here, you know what I mean, for your good. And if we kind of shift it, but I mean, we're also human, right?
Yeah,
so we're gonna go through that and experience that. But I do believe that God has a way, a perspective, that even as leaders, that oftentimes we're not tapping into that. We're just kind of looking at it from fleshly eyes. I've trying to learn even kind of what expectations setting, what expectations are realistic for me. So, mm-hmm, I used to have those disappointments when I didn't see a whole bunch of people. But then I started realizing you need to see the right people there.
That's right.
Because it's not going to be 100%. You got what I mean? But if I see the right people there, then I know things are going good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Jesus be okay if none of the Pharisees became apostles. But if some of his disciples didn't become an apostle,
yeah,
then he might have been like, oh, snap, I really wasn't effective then, right?
Right.
But because his disciples became, I think then that put things in perspective.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of times as pastors, most of the time you see a lot of pastors, they go by what they see with their natural eye,
yeah,
instead of what they see, you know, you don't know whose life you're touching. And just because that person, I don't see 100 people there. I don't see, you know, 50 people there. Well, the 20 that you have there, somebody going to get something from the message that you preach.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody going to be, and I always say, if we can just touch one,
mm-hmm,
you know, if you could just touch one life, one person, you know, that's good enough for me, because now you know that God is effective in that one person.
That's true.
And maybe it wasn't meant for all those other people to be there at that time. So you know, I always say, work with what you got, you know? So whoever there, that's who I'm going to preach to, and whoever comes. And I tell my wife all the time, I say, you know, I used to, in the beginning, I used to always worry about, oh, this person ain't here. This person didn't show up to church, and God had a word. And the Lord said, no, stop doing that. You don't have to worry. If they're not there, it was not meant for them to be there.
Right. Hmm. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we have to, I think, like today, you know, I took my boys to the beach and we went up there and spent about 2-3 hours at the beach in prayer. And personal, intimate prayer, I separate them because, you know, we're homeschooling them. And I did this with my two older boys. Each one that we homeschooled their middle school years, we would take them, when I lived in North Miami, we'd take them to Olita Park and really teach them how to develop a intimate relationship with mm-hmm. God, you know? I've been doing that for 20-something years since I've been, that's one of the first things when I was discipled mm-hmm. as a new Christian, it was really put into me the importance of a quality, consistent devotional life, you know, spending time in prayer, listening to the Holy Spirit, meditating on the Word. And I find that when I'm not doing that, and as I want my sons to understand that, I mean, when I die, and we can die tomorrow, we can die today, I want my legacy to be ultimately that I pass down to my kids those spiritual practices, right. You know,
yeah.
And I find that when we're not in the Word like that,
yeah.
when we're not in prayer like that, our hearts grow faint,
yeah.
you know, and they get heavier.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a verse here I want to bring up. Let me see, where is it at? Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and transition over to our screen. And Jesus in Matthew 24, it's the passage about him talking about the last days and the signs that will be there when he returns. And then he says here in this passage, he says, so you also must be ready because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. So he's talking about having your fire and your lamp burning. He gives a parable about the 10 virgins and five right. of them were waiting, five were not. And then he says, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants, right? And in his household to give them their food at the proper time. It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. So,
wow.
And so today as I was spending time with the Lord, he was just reminding me because I want to remind, you know, you two as pastors who, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not as active as a pastor no more, but nevertheless, in all of the 20 years of pastoral ministry, and you're going through the same thing that pastors go through. But yeah. sometimes, whatever vocation and career you're in, you can think, you know, man, my woes are unique and different. But no, business people, therapists, you know, they need more clients. You need more members. You know, they need more money. They got rent. They got this. They got that. You got rent. You got, you know, yeah. different expenses.
Yeah.
And so all of us are really in the same boat because at the end of the day, all of us are providing a service.
Right.
I don't care if you are selling homes or you're pastoring or you're counseling. You're providing a service,
right.
and you get discouraged in your work because things aren't moving fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have enough clients, members, customers, whatever you want to call them. They're people you serve.
Right.
But yet the Lord today was reminding me, first of all, he's given to each one of us a calling and gifts and careers. And he's the one who calls us. He's the one who opens doors that no man can shut. He's the one who closes doors that no man can open. And he was reminding me today, Jack, I need you to stop worrying about the outcomes,
right?
T.D. Jakes talks about he didn't expect his church to grow so large and his influence to grow so large. Joseph, you know, when you right. read his story in Genesis, Moses, when you read David, when Samuel anointed him, David had no clue the scope of his calling right. and his impact. But even if David never was king over Israel, I believe David, even as a shepherd, when he was out there tending to the sheep, he did everything with his whole heart unto the Lord because those sheep meant a lot to him.
That's true.
And so what the Lord is reminding me, it's not about the scope of your sheep or your influence, but it's about the faithfulness of what you do with what you have. And Jesus said, he who's faithful with a little bit will be faithful a lot. And let me just say this one thing, and I want to hear you guys' thoughts. The Lord was challenging me, rebuked me, because lately I've been discouraged. You know, even though I've seen God's blessing in my life and in my business and my ministry, incredible blessings, right?
Mm-hmm.
The heart is never satisfied.
Wow.
Ecclesiastes, Solomon said that most people, in Ecclesiastes, he says, I see under the sun that most people are driven by envy.
Yeah.
And you have to be careful about this as a pastor, as an evangelist, as a businessman.
I know.
Because the Lord was showing me today, because I was reading in Mark 7, where he says, out of the heart come sexual immorality, adultery, theft, murder, envy. And he was like, this is you, Jack. You are a wretched sinner, man. And that's why I think it's so important to get with the Lord, because that's he will show you your heart. He's like, you're driven by envy. You got lust. You got greed. You got, I mean, you convolute things, you know. You put a spin on things in your sales and your presence. You know, we all do. We're hustlers, and we present things and at the end of the day, we can't jive God, right? He sees right through us. And he's like, this is your heart. You're wicked. And first of all, if it wasn't for my blood, you wouldn't even have access to me right now, because I give you access to my throne. And number two, I don't care about what you think should be happening in your life, where you should be. I care about your faithfulness. And he started pointing out things to me, little errands and little things I needed to take care of, and people I need to call and projects I need to finish. You have not been faithful. And faithfulness is not only with the things that you're supposed to do, but projects that you have for other people. You know, things that God has told you to do in service to people. And he's like, right now, that's why there's a frustration, and your pipes are clogged, because the pipe of blessing, right, where God's flowing and you're experiencing the overflow, because you're not being faithful in these little things. How am I going to give you more?
And
we're not always that way, but we do get lazy.
Right.
We get distracted.
Content.
You know, the weeds come in and begin to choke the word. Remember what Jesus said? He said, be careful that the weeds of this world, the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the anxieties of life, right? You're doing all this stuff, but you're not being faithful to the garden and the soil that he's called you. And we lose track, man. We start getting involved in things we shouldn't. We start running around with people we shouldn't be, and we lose the quality and the faithfulness of the things that God's called us to.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's because we're not under his lordship. We're not listening to him.
Right.
You know, you can't be a king, a priest, a prophet, and everything. You know, you got to know what God's called you to.
And
do that with faithfulness and quality. And God will begin to open up the floodgates again.
Yeah.
So, again, as I hear Jake's, I'm hearing a man who struggled at times to even continue in the faithfulness of his call. But yet God opened it up because he was faithful. To the scope and of his call. You know, some of us have 5 gifts, some of us have 2, some of us have 10. And God calls us to exercise and to execute those gifts, some more so at seasons than others.
Right.
But again, man, this, you know, that's my encouragement to the people who are watching and to us here in this circle right now.
You got me kind of excited. Because, you know, One, I was one that even before I became a pastor, I was one that really never thought I was going to be a pastor, never really, you know, wanted the job in the beginning, because I seen how my apostle and my bishop went through so much with people. And I began to say, I don't want that. I don't want to deal with people. You know, I don't want to be able to, you know, I have to be. And now that I'm there and I'm dealing with the same things a lot of times, you know, because when you have such a passion for and a love for God's people, I mean, to the point where you're helping people, where a person come to you and they don't have a place to stay, and you helping them get a place to stay, and you helping them, I need to do this, pastor, this going on in my life, and you trying to be that, you know, be that helpmate to that person, because you know that this is my member, you know, I'm the pastor over the sheep, and they're coming to me with a problem, and I try my best to solve and help them with it. And I say, Lord, you know, I'm glad to do that, I'm glad to help people, but my biggest thing is, you know, who's helping me?
Yeah,
in my need, you know. And then when you know, people come to you when their rent is due, or when this is going on, and a lot of times as a pastor, you're like, you know, who can I go to other than God?
And then let me interject here. I'm gonna say something that's going to blow you away. We are not going to see revival and blessing in anything we do. And I believe this, and I've seen it. I've actually seen it, even with people who aren't believers.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we prioritize God, spouse, family, and in our vocation. Our vocation could be full-time ministry. It could be bivocational. It could be running a business, entrepreneur. And I really believe in that is self-care. 100%. I believe it's only in the overflow of our own peace and our own joy and our own self-control, right? Because, you know, the fruits of the Spirit is different than the gifts of the Spirit. The fruits of the Spirit is a constant abiding attribute that Christians should possess. And some of those, when I talked about it at your anniversary, joy. We should always have joy. When we don't have joy, it means something is rotten in the core of what's flowing from Christ to us. Like, it's not flowing. And Jesus talked about that in John 15. He said, if you don't abide in me, you'll be like the branch who withers away. And I really believe that, because God's going to show up in signs and wonders in our ministry. He's going to show up with blessing, and he's going to give us resources and finances if we're faithful in the distribution of them. Because God's shown me, the more I help people with the gifts, time, talents, and treasures give me, the more he gives me. That's the number one lesson. But he's also taught me help the right people. Because, you know, Paul says, entrust this to reliable men who will be faithful. He's taught me you shouldn't be discipling and mentoring everyone, and you should not be cultivating deep relationships with everyone. Only people who are on the same spiritual, vocational page as you, right? They're on the same wavelength. And Jesus did that. Mm-hmm. And so, but everything, it's like this cup, right? Like, unless this cup is full, it can't overflow.
Right.
If this cup right here has no water in and of itself, it can't overflow and give water to other people. The only way this thing could be of a constant resource to other people, it has to first be filled and then overflowing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why the Bible says, be filled with the Spirit. Yes. Speak to one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. When you're so filled with God that you find yourself singing in the car, worship songs.
Right.
When it's not just this, because as a pastor, I found myself only singing in Sunday services, only preaching on the pulpit, only excited during the service, but not preaching on Tuesday, not singing on Wednesday at 10 a.m., not discipling on Thursday at 10 p.m., not preaching the word at Walmart or on social media with passion, like I'm on a pulpit and 1,000 people are listening to me.
Yeah.
You know, if I get into a small group with 10 people, I'm kind of less interested versus if it's a group of 1,000 people.
Right.
And you don't see that in apostles. You don't see that with Jesus. He's the intensity, the zeal is always there. And I really believe, because personally they were overflowing. They were always on fire. They were always filled with joy. They were always, because those are manifestations
of the Spirit.
That are there, long as we walk in the Spirit, and we're filled with the Spirit, and it don't matter whether I really believe that the Lord has shown me, Jack, the more you abide in me, the more you have self care, the more you take care of your body, the more you take care of your marriage, the more you are a steward over your own health and spiritual health, where you're hearing me and you're allowing me to rebuke you and correct you, taking the plank out of your eye. So before you take the speck out of other people's eye as a pastoral counselor, as an evangelist, as a missionary, you got to let me be your missionary. Right. Let me be your therapist. Let me be your father and convictor and comforter.
Yeah.
And it's a very intimate thing. And then I will create opportunities for you on a national level, international level. And the irony is, when you're in that place, you don't care about it.
No, you don't.
Because you're filled. When you're already content and you're good, right? It's like, I don't care if you like me. I don't care if social media applauds me. I don't care if other pastors affirm me. And I found myself in these little subtleties, in these traps, and they breed frustration.
Yeah.
You know, you want more. It's more affirmation, more glorification, more things, more shiny objects in your life, and more pats on your back. When you're filled like this, with the fire and the water of God, these elements, right? These pure organic elements that come from God. You have something to give other people.
It's true.
Independent of them affirming you and being there for you. And I'm telling you, Pastor Reese, God is speaking to you today. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, I need you to get filled with me. I need you to go and let me deal with you personally and intimately. Mm. And I'm telling you, that's why the discipline of our devotional life, yeah, mm-hmm, in our physical life, yeah, in our mental health life, and I like you to touch on this, is so critical.
Yeah. Right.
And if we I've read stories of healers and apostles and evangelists that God's used mightily, where they just touch people and get healed, and they all seem to have this one commitment that they talk about. Mm-hmm. Catherine Kuhlman, yeah, they talk about the intimacy and the prayer life and the listening life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they didn't need ministry. They don't need it no more. They don't need the event. Yeah. They don't need that miracle service. Right. It's not that gets them excited.
Right.
It's their relationship with Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Personally.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah. I think, you know, you touched on a lot of different things, but just touching on the self-care aspect of it. You know, there's been a rise in the church of people who profess Christ committing suicide.
Yeah.
Mm.
And a lot of pastors and so I'm praying. I'm like, God, you know, like, this is supposed to be your servants. Like, how? And what God said is that they lost time with me in prayer. Mm-hmm. And so they stopped seeking him, and they begin to start just doing the work instead of taking care of their personal time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, even a lot of therapists, too, a lot of therapists are committing suicide because they're giving, and they become alcoholics, mm-hmm, and they become drug, you know, abusers. What the number one reason is because they refuse to take time to put back into them. Wow. And the way that we as believers do that, and I find myself, if I didn't spend time with God, and I just go about my daily, you,
yeah,
know, and then I go a couple of days, and all of a sudden I'm just empty, and I'm like, I'm tired, I'm frustrated, yeah, with people, I'm in session, I can't even think straight because I'm frustrated with me. So now I'm getting frustrated with you, yeah, because you're not respond. I don't show grace.
Yeah.
I don't show the love that. Yeah. And then so when I get back into that place, I'm like, okay, right, this is what I was missing.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine going through that your entire life.
Yeah.
And carrying and trying to carry other people's burdens that weighs heavy on you.
Yeah.
Like as far as with pastors and counselors, or even, yeah, just business people, you have people that $1 million corporations. And then they can't, they're like, oh man, I got 100 employees under me. They're depending on me.
Right.
And so when that weight gets on, yeah, them, without Christ, right, man, it's hard, yeah, to, mm-hmm, deal with.
Yeah.
It. Yeah. It really is. It's really, yeah, hard to deal with.
I want to say something, Pastor Jack said. The biggest thing that I have done for me to help me to realize, because after a while, you know, you just see yourself doing work. And I thank God, because God began to deal with me. That's not about doing the work, but, you know, really abiding in him more.
Yeah.
And I thank God, because I've been doing that more, where I have those times where in the morning, now I take that time out now to just spend some time with me and God. I lock myself in my room and I just get to spend some time with him, you know, and where things used to frustrate me, things used to aggravate me, things used to get on my nerves. A lot of times now I'm able to, you know, be free of those things, because a lot of times you want things to happen, you're trying to get stuff happening, and then sometimes, you know, and I can hear God's voice sometimes when I feel like I'm getting frustrated. I can hear God, no, come to me.
Mm.
Just start talking to me.
Yeah.
You know, don't talk to nobody else. Don't talk to your wife. Don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And I begin to start talking to him, and I feel better when I do that.
Amen.
And now even to the point of, in the middle of the night, sometimes God will just wake me up, and I just go in a little private room by myself just to talk with him. And I said, Lord, I know it's a reason you woke me up, you know, because you probably saw something coming that I haven't even seen yet.
Yeah.
So, and God has his way with me. I don't know about anybody else, but God has this way with me where he brings things back to my remembrance.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the times I was really frustrated with some, you know, things that was going on. And I, you know, I didn't think I was giving my all into it, and I was really putting a lot of pressure on me, had nothing to do with nobody else. I was putting pressure on myself because I felt like I could do more, you know? And God began to deal with me and showed me something in a vision. And he does that. Like, a lot of time I could be sitting there and I'll have this vision of something. And when at this time I was having a vision of something that happened to me a long time ago. And God came back to me and said, you remember when this happened? And when I went back and looked at that, I'm like, yeah. He said, back then, you know, you did the work, but you cared for me first. And I'm saying, okay, yeah, God, I really hear you on that, because I did. When it wasn't just doing the work, but I did it because of. And he helped me realize this not about you. And that's my message I always preach now. It's not about us. It's about him. It's all about him. And, you know, God cares about us too, but remember, it's his kingdom.
Jesus said, my burden is light and my yoke is easy, right? And I think, you know, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. We do. You know, and one of the things that God's really been teaching me the last few years is this issue of simplicity, right? Again, you have to constantly get rid of things. Our wardrobe, keep it simple. Our schedules, keep it simple. Our you know, what is it we want to accomplish? You know, we can probably only accomplish, as far as legacy, a few things and do it well, you know? And making sure our life has synergy, right? Everything is kind of flowing together, and not, the energy is not flowing in different directions. But this issue of simplicity, this issue of making sure that, you know, many hands make the work light, right? Make the burden light. So making sure that we're not doing more than we ourselves can handle. So I think there's a lot of lessons there about persevering through pain, because pain sometimes is just an indicator, something's wrong. And we shouldn't frown at pain. We should understand that God is trying to speak to us and get our attention, you know? I really believe pain is an indicator. And then there's pain that's controllable, and there's pain that comes as uncontrollable. It just comes circumstantially. And God says, I'll give you the joy, the power, the ability you need to endure under it.
Grace.
And then there's pain that God is saying, I need you to get rid of this pain by changing your behavior. And I believe most of the pain that we are experiencing is due to behavior and thinking, and we keep falling into the same ditch. And I think that's why it's important for men like us and women to be in circles and to be in fellowship with people. You know, the Bible says iron sharpens iron, that are helping us rethink our decisions and challenging us. Hebrews says, do not forsake the assembly of one another, but encourage and spur one another on towards love and good work. That word spur, in the Greek, it's this idea of poking. They would take a sword in the military and poke each other, and poke each other. We should be saying things to each other through the Spirit and through times of sharing and through the prophetic word that comes to us without even sometimes us realizing it. That really makes us rethink and look at. And I think it's ultimately always going back to the Word. We need to, you know, the Bible says, let the Word of God dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another. We need to always be sharing God's Word, sharing what God's teaching us, and sharing what He's teaching. That's why I believe so much in multidimensional communication. That believers need to be sharing and challenging, because we'll get wisdom and instruction that literally can change the direction of your life and remove pain, financial pain, relational pain. Sometimes we find ourselves in constant social drama, you know, and it's just like, okay, it's just, sometimes you just need a word. I remember, and I'll give you an example. There was an apostle in Miami. When we were pastoring in North Miami, he had a church right down the street from us. I forgot his name, Apostle something, I forgot his name. But he called me one day out of the blue, said, man, you came to me, to my mind while I was in prayer. And he said, and I want to basically share something with you. And I was like, sure, I'm all ears. He was like, you know, I really believe that you're trying to help too many people and the wrong people. I see you dragging people versus, you know, and it was true because during that time I was very frustrated. And you know a little bit, Vince, I've shared with you. I was trying to, like, help people. And we, one thing we cannot do, and this is a word for you guys who right now are in a corporate church setting, is you cannot drag. And Kevin, you were witness to that, how frustrated I was, you know, especially in a corporate church setting. You try to help people, but really you're just dragging them. I believe in leadership empowerment, meaning I empower leaders who themselves are movers and shakers. I'm not trying to be their mover and shaker. I'm just there to help them with tools and resources they need, because they're like Nehemiah, they're already building the wall. They got the sword and the plow. They just need me to hey, I got a new plow sharpener. You know, I can make that. I can help you with your communication be more effective. I can help you with technology, but I don't need to put that in them. And the Lord has shown me that, especially leaders, business leaders, ministry leaders, nonprofit, you cannot, because this will cause so much pain in your life. You cannot try to drag people that don't want to be dragged, because it will wear you down. Yes, and when that apostle told me that, it was a timely word. It was a hard word. He's like, you're dragging people, you're frustrated, and you're frustrating them, because what happens when you drag people, that's too much weight.
And you're pulling on them.
And you get frustrated because they're, you know, and you start wanting to kick them. You start wanting to kick, you know.
Hey, but you know, you learn that in ministry, you know. You know, because they always use, you know, that the saying in the Bible where Jesus said he left the 99 and went after back and get the one. So a lot of times, you know, I've done it as a pastor. You go after that one and you try to drag them along to get their life back together, and try to, and they don't want to be dragged. Some want to stay out there in the world. Some want to stay, go back to where the way they used to be. And some, you know, I've learned now that I'm almost 53 years old, I've learned now, if they don't want to, God told me this. He said, if they don't want to come, you can't force somebody to come if they don't want to come with you. And if they can't come with you, they're not a part of the destiny where I'm taking you.
I'm going to submit something to you that this is going to be pretty controversial. I believe no leader, whether they're a business leader, nonprofit leader, or pastor leader, should ever be investing, far as I'm talking about, like, mentorship, availability, for more than 12 people. 12 is the number of government. Everything is established with 12. You could have 7, you could have 6, you could have 5. But if you are pouring into and constantly counseling and helping, now, if you do it as a profession, where you're paid, you know, per hour or group counseling, that's a whole different ballgame.
Right.
But I'm talking about organizational development, and I'm going to touch on that in our organizational development groups. Because if you're pouring into more than 12 people in leadership development, you know, I was just watching the draft there's a new special on Amazon about the Dallas Cowboys. I forgot what it's called, but it kind of gets into the background when they're drafting.
Right.
What's his name? Jones.
Jerry Jones.
Jay Jones and stuff. And their new coach, I forgot his name.
Garrett.
They have a quote in their coaching room, right? They got a quote. It says, "Build the team that you want to coach." Mm-hmm. And I think what's his name?
Lombardi.
Not Lombardi. Who was their previous coach?
Landry.
Yeah. I guess I don't know. He may have said the quote, or one of the other famous Dallas Cowboy coaches, but he said, "Build the team that you want to coach." And I may be paraphrasing there. And I just immediately thought about pastors and executive and entrepreneurs, right? And their whole Cowboys philosophy is that takes years, but that's what they do. They try to build dynasties, but the problem is we want a team, but we don't want to invest into a few core people, you know, to build a team you want to coach. Because I was on championship football teams as a running back. You can't do that with the whole team.
No.
You got to invest into your backs, your quarterbacks, your cornerback, you know, your middle. There's like probably about 10, 12 core players.
It's your primary. Yeah.
It's your primary.
Yeah, your primary leaders or your primary players, that's going to carry the weight.
And they influence the other rest of the players.
Right.
And when it comes to especially church leadership, when a pastor is not investing into a core team of, I'd say, no more than 12 people, and they're the ones you're head of your deacons, your small groups, your counseling ministries, your youth ministry, and you guys are building a bond. You're working through the kinks. You guys can yell and cry and scream and still understand love. You're going on retreats, and so that takes focus. When a senior pastor is trying to counsel the visitor, the new person, everyone, and I'm telling you, man, there's never a core that then creates a culture in the team. And you're doing something that Jesus didn't even do.
Right.
Jesus did not pastor more than 12 people.
Right.
He preached as an evangelist.
Yeah, to more people.
He preached to other people. He sent out evangelistic teams of 72, but he pastored 12. That is, he discipled them. He shepherded them. They went out and did ministry together.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I got a small group of, I think, 8-9 people.
Yeah.
But you know what's happened, and you're part of that group, is we've developed a bond where that is, and that's what God did. He basically took me back to square one and said, okay, you came out to Miami, you did it wrong. And I violated my own principles because I knew this, because we had experienced great movement in L.A. But I came here because I wanted it fast. And you cannot have a championship cowboy team unless you develop the team that you want to coach, and that means you go back to the basics. Our group, we spent just a year and just learning how to meditate and pray together, and not have the anxiety of production, but actually experiencing the presence of God, so that the evangelism work that we began to do and the missional work we began to do. And starting of micro churches and house churches, okay, throughout the world, the DNA we have, you give birth and you raise your kids the way you are, but if you do that too quick, you know, when I counsel young people, I tell them, hey, while you're single, you need to become the man and the woman of God that you want in your spouse, so that when you come together, you are what you want. And then you begin to produce with those little ones who you are.
Right.
Like begins like.
Yeah.
If you're scandalous, you don't know how to experience the presence of God. You're not developing yourself vocationally and personally. You're not disciplined. You're not faithful in ministry as a single person. You know,
right.
You're not going to have that in your spouse. You got to become that which you want. And when God brings you together, you'll begin to naturally form, and I believe pastorally and as leaders, as entrepreneurs, we will start companies that take on our DNA.
Yeah.
They'll be creative, they'll be passionate, they'll be disciplined, but we got to be willing to go through that time of relational leadership development, which takes years.
That's the process. That's submitted to the process.
That's
the process. And I think also having that vision of what it takes to get that, one of the things that it really blessed me, one of the things that have really kind of taken me to be more of a leader, because one of the things I've become, I'd love to be a great preacher, pastor, but I really want to be a great leader.
Yeah.
Like above everything, like if I'm a great leader, I think I would have accomplished what I was purposed to do. But you know, having those vision and write it down, Jack, you've been pressing us to develop that business plan.
Yeah.
Right? And follow that business plan, because then now I think our expectations
70-60%. The business plan creates structure, but God, plans in his heart, but God determines our steps.
Yeah, our steps.
Yeah.
But I think maybe for me personally, oftentimes my expectations are not met. Part of it is because I'm not clear about what my expectations are.
Yeah.
And so then now any and everything can become like a viable expectation, because then, you know, because nothing gets me, because I'm not clear about what I'm supposed to do. But I think when we can begin to kind of identify those key things, as simple as it is, I think then it kind of makes our expectations a little bit more manageable. Then we're not as disappointed if things don't work out the way that they're supposed to work out. And I do think this, I think part of it is recognizing what the hurt is or what the pain is, right? Like what is it that I'm feeling some pain, some hurt right now.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, just really seeking God. All right, God, you know, I may have not been connecting with you.
Right.
Here I am right now. You've got my attention. And one thing that we've said before, finding some people that you can be honest and be and vulnerable with, and like, man, I felt like quitting this week. But I didn't. I sought the Lord. Here's what he said.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? To at least get that off of your chest, so that way you don't feel like I'm having to deal with this by myself, right?
Yeah.
And I think those kinds of principles, just much like you teaching your son certain kinds of principles, those kinds of things may help us to be more fruitful and manage better the things that we have. Because I do believe this. A good steward is not just someone who maintains and takes care of things, but a good steward helps to add value to what you have, right?
For sure.
You know, so like even God has blessed us with gifts and talents. I can't be a good steward of that gift if it's just potential and it's just sitting there and it's not doing anything, right? My best stewardship is to use it and have it to multiply, to bless not just me, but to bless others.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, man, we're going to be right back, and we're going to be discussing a little bit more about this this issue of Kavanaugh and what's the implications for Roe versus Wade, and we're going to continue this discussion.
I'm ready to die like Biggie.
Are you the dogs, man?
Hold up. Hold up. Okay, let's get it. Hold up.
Body bag. Pop it, rubber, baby.
Yeah. Ice cold. Hold up. About to hit him in the chest on this. Hold up, who that? Had your chance to shine, but you blew that. Reap what you sowed, boy, I think I need to clue that. Dropping bombs on these cats, Hiroshima in a beamer, dropping bombs in these raps. Eyes open, mouth closed when you step up in my domain. Everybody lit, so I'm about to bring the propane. Many still won't get it. I'm aiming at your brain, but I'ma hit you in your spirit. Real talk, blood raw. Only goals that you got is the 12 in your jaw.
Come on.
No future, no plan. You trying to be a savage, bro? I'm trying to be a man. Trying to touch the sky like them buildings in Dubai.
Yeah.
Trying to flip the game on his back for a die.
Yeah.
Y'all can debate over who's the dopest. Ripper just trying to bring hope to the hopeless.
Get him.
Yeah, I know what you thought. This was sex, money, drugs. I ain't thinking about a thought. Beware of them dimes, boy. I know that they fine, boy. Don't show them your hand until they show you they mine, boy. These snakes in these bars throwing ninja stars. And they aiming for the dudes with them fancy cars. Watch out. See, we all got options. Grow or stay the same. Live or be dead. I'd rather choose life. The dead gets no bread. And all these streets give you is a hole in your head. All these streets give you is a hole in your head. Everybody talking out the side of their neck. Everybody out here dying for respect. Sense ain't coming when you're trying to chase a check. You're ready for that life, boy. You better bring a body bag.
Hold up. Body bag. Hold up. Body bag. Hold up. Body bag.
You're ready for that life, boy. You better bring a body bag. All about the money, bullets and bras. Blind had the wrong definition of hard. Gamble with my life, tore my family apart. Had to die to myself before they put me in a body bag.
Body bag.
I'm ready to die like Biggie.
Body bag.
I'm ready to die like Biggie. Life ain't a box of chocolate. It's crabs in a bucket. Get a lockpick. Peep who you rock with, I'm hot with. Every single line I deliver, couldn't mumble if I tried. My team won't let it slide. Bringing you the creme de la crema, muy caliente. My whole camp excelente. Got more bars than a cell block. When I tell them hell hot, they ain't trying to hear me till that flesh rot. They traveled the road that was wide and packed. I took the alleyway and went round the back. The paper, the power, taming these dames. I played the game, it's all in vain. My stable was full with faces, no names. Married and all, I had no shame. My Johnson survived like magic. No virus in the package, but I still got baggage. Still got days when I SMH. I look back, can't believe I'm still in the...
All right, well, we are back here at the Hakimian Show, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the Kavanaugh being placed now on the Supreme Court, and what does that mean for the issue of abortion, Roe versus Wade. And we definitely are open to hear your ideas about this issue, and what do you feel? Do you feel that having a Judge Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, it's more positive than negative? Do you think that we're going to end up regretting that? Do you think that that whole process was hijacked? be interesting to hear your thoughts and join us in this conversation on Facebook Live. And so, hey, what do you guys think about this whole thing that happened?
I think is a good thing. I mean, it just shows that, you know, they made a decision, and the decision was to put him in there. And I think he's going to do a good job. I really think, far as abortion is concerned, you know, it's a lot of times people want to look and say, you know, oh, you forcing someone to have a child that they don't want and this and that. But I don't agree with abortion. I just had this thing about, you know, someone killing another human being or a child. Yeah. It just make me cringe when I hear about it, you know, because it's still a human being. They still have a spirit. And they may not be developed all the way yet and all those things that they say, but they're still a human being.
Yeah, I think the issue, the last time we talked, mm-hmm. was that, listen, if they find something with him, mm-hmm. after this whole FBI investigation, then, you know, then that needs to be taken into consideration,
right,
with him
right.
being assaulted. But I think at the end of the day, people fail to realize Kavanaugh was not in the criminal court.
Mm-mm.
He was up for a job interview,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had the right to say whether they agree with him or not. But this whole issue with, I think the reason why a lot of people on the left, the liberal side of it, are, you know, they are pushing so much against him is because he's pro-life. And with him being in the Supreme Court, that gives them the opportunity to repeal Roe versus Wade.
Exactly.
And so they are adamantly against that. And so even just looking at it from a biblical standpoint, man, you know, they dealt with this in the Bible with dealing with Molech and mm-hmm. child sacrifice to Molech, and dealing with it, how we're, even just as a black person, how detrimental it is for us as a community. Since what, 1973, mm-hmm. I believe we've aborted 28 million black babies, and so
yes,
you know, a lot of people don't realize, they fail to realize the number one killer for our culture, the African American population, is not AIDS, it's not heart disease, it's not cancer, it's actually abortion.
Right.
So, with that aspect, man, I'm glad that he's there. But then on the flip side to that is, you know, if, you know, he did do what he said to, you know, Dr. Ford, I feel bad for him. You
mm-hmm.
know, I do feel bad. But that's if that came out that he did, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said before about that the last time we spoke, you know, if the FBI was to find something, and obviously from what I understood, they didn't really find anything. It was mainly, you know, still he say, she say, his word against her word.
Yeah, well, the issue was they nobody really corroborated her story.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that, I mean, there's many different implications that could be for that specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know, or something was going on. I mean, you just never really truly know.
Right, right.
So, but at the end of the day, in order for you to believe something, you have to have evidence.
Right. You got to have some kind of evidence.
If there is no evidence, then how can you expect me to believe something? If you tell me two water bottles and I get two water bottles,
mm-hmm.
then that equals four. That I have evidence that 2 + 2 = 4. You understand what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying? But in, you know, as I said before, it's kind of really, you know, that's 30-something years ago. But it's really hard to prove.
Yeah. And,
you know,
think of this, too. A lot of people don't want to get involved. Even if it did, let's say, on circumstances, something did happen. You know, you have a lot of people just don't want to get involved with that, because why? Now you got questions going to be asked. Well, what happened? Then you don't want to be made like a liar, because that's something that happened years ago that you ain't really had, you know, really, or you just saw something, but you don't know, you can't remember what you saw from back then.
Right.
So a lot of times, you know, somebody just don't want to really get involved in it.
Yeah.
And it was so long ago And that's my whole thing. It's so long ago. I mean, like, if something did happen, it's so long ago. It's over. You know, a lot of people are not even thinking about that anymore, you know. And even to the point, you know, I heard one of the representatives, I think he was on the Republican side, he brought up Bill Cosby and this is not a Bill Cosby. Sure. I heard that, and I didn't even like that, because why, if something, all these things did happen, why it took you so long to say something? And why, if it took you this long to say something, then, you know, what's the use of saying something now? And now something that happened a long time ago. And then you, not just that, but you went back.
I think the issue is the point with accusation versus you being, you know, something that you can prove. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying? But even, you know, you touched on the Bill Cosby thing. I think what we're, especially us as black people, we forget that people are human and people are flawed, and people were born into sin with total depravity. And we look at Bill Cosby as, oh, this is Dr. Huxtable.
Right.
You know,
right.
We can't separate the two and say, even though this is Dr. Huxtable, this was the ideal black family. We automatically assume that he's innocent because of what character he played. Mm-hmm. But even if you read the deposition, I was talking to a lot of people about that, is that he admitted, Bill Cosby actually admitted to drugging those women.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to defend something that he admitted just solely simply because he's black.
Yeah.
And I think that's problematic too, because we get caught up in what Vody Balcom says, is we get caught up in ethnic Gnosticism. Because I'm black, I know what happened. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so because he's black, oh, I already know, because we both black.
Well, and I think, you know, again, I don't fully know how that trial and what the evidence was. I've heard both sides basically argue that he was either guilty, he was innocent, obviously. And those who are saying he was innocent are saying he was basically pursued because of his blackness and his power. But nevertheless, I think in principle, you know, we don't really know. Like a lot of pro-life people strongly wanted Kavanaugh to become Supreme Court judge, because they believe he'll also help the bench lean towards overturning Roe versus Wade. And of course, I hope that we do, because abortion is an inherent evil. It's inherently murder. Unless a woman's life is in danger, then it's up to her to decide what path she wants to take. But if you look at the hearing when he was basically confirmed. Being interviewed to be confirmed, this is what he said. Now check this out.
The first question I have of you is, what do you mean by settled law? I tried to ask earlier, do you believe it is correct law? Have your views on whether Roe is settled precedent or could be overturned? And has your views changed since you were in the Bush White House?
Senator, I said that it's settled as a precedent of the Supreme Court entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis. One of the important things to keep in mind about Roe v. Wade is that it has been reaffirmed many times over the past 45 years, as you know. And most prominently, most importantly, reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992. And as you well recall, Senator, I know when that case came up, the Supreme Court didn't just reaffirm it in passing. The court specifically went through all the factors of stare decisis in considering whether to overrule it. And the joint opinion of Justice Kennedy, Justice O'Connor, and Justice Souter at great length went through those factors. That was the question presented in the case.
Could I interrupt you to say, since you mentioned stare decisis, and I sat on 9 of these hearings, and when the subject comes up, The person says, I will follow stare decisis. And they get confirmed, and then, of course, they don't. So I think knowing going into it, how you make a judgment on these issues is really important to our vote as whether to support you or not. Because I don't want to go back to those death tolls in this country. And I truly believe that women should be able to control their own reproductive systems within, obviously, some concern for a viable fetus. Mm-hmm.
And I understand your point of view on that, Senator, and I understand how passionate and how deeply people feel about this issue. I understand the importance of the issue. I understand the importance that people attach to the Roe v. Wade decision, to the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision. I don't live in a bubble. I understand, I live in the real world. I understand the importance of the issue.
The first question I have.
All right, so I want to first of all say, let me put this mic back on. I want to first of all say that, you know, the irony about Roe versus Wade, and I'll bring this up here on the screen, just so I'm going to read an article here. This is Roe versus Wade decided by majority Republican nominated court. And just so you know the history, Warren Berger was appointed by Richard Nixon, Republican, William O. Douglas, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Democrat, Thurgood Marshall, Lyndon Johnson, Lewis Powell, Richard Nixon, Republican, Potter Stewart, Dwight Eisenhower, Republican, Harry Blackmun, by Richard Nixon, Republican, William Joseph Brennan, Jr., Dwight Eisenhower, Republican. Dissenting opinion was William Rehnquist. He was a Republican, of course, that dissented Roe versus Wade. Byron White, he was appointed by John F. Kennedy, a Democrat. So I mention that to say that when you study the history of the Republican Party, the Republican Party, even when Lincoln was there, many of the Northern Republicans did not care about African slaves.
Right.
That's just the reality.
Right.
Especially the moderate Republicans.
Right.
To me, moderate Republicans, the centrist Republicans, are all about money. Okay, much like liberal Democrats, especially white liberal Democrats. It's all about money. At the end of the day, you know, the Civil War was first and foremost about money.
Right.
Okay, the Northern colonies versus the Southern colonies, what was the tariffs that was being imposed that was affecting the agriculture, the cotton industry, the tobacco industry, all those industries, and the way the technology, right, or the boom, the industrial boom was taking place in the North. So when you really get into it, slaves, blacks were nothing more than a commodity, okay? Mm. And of course, it was about political power and economic power, and it's been that way. Mm-hmm. For most of the Republican Party, Lincoln was very reluctant to do anything on behalf of blacks, but he vehemently, powerfully said, if we change the tariffs, I'm willing to go to war for tariffs, because you know the tariffs were really benefiting the northern states. You know that they were imposing on other countries, right, and import that was coming in. So there was never money. Folks were willing to die and go to war. So what I'm saying is to say, okay, that the Republican Party that went into the Civil War was influenced by what we call the radical Republicans. They were the evangelicals, wow, who were radical about the freedom and the dignity of blacks and all people. Mm-hmm. And they were motivated by faith. Mm-hmm. And I'll submit to you today, okay, mm-hmm, that nothing has changed. It's the crazy Christians who are for social justice, who are for reparations, you know, that black slaves, they were the ones who were putting pressure on Lincoln to impose reparations and to give it to the slaves. And then they assassinated Lincoln. And then I believe it was Andrew Jackson, forgot the president, the vice president that took over his seat, who basically is Jackson.
I think it was Jackson.
Yeah, he was a Democrat. He immediately did away with it. But if they would have gave reparations to all the former slaves, mm-hmm. land, grants, and the reason why the blacks wanted reparations was they were saying, we don't want to be economically dependent upon you as whites,
right.
which is exactly what happened due to the fact that they didn't get reparations for all the centuries of labor, which I believe, I'm a strong believer in reparations.
Yeah.
And a lot of Republicans are against that. They get mad at me when I say that. But to me, it's not a welfare or entitlement issue. It's an issue of economic justice. It's an issue of fairness. And anyone that can demonstrate a connection to slavery ought to be, and it doesn't have to be money. It could be land. It could be educational grants. It could be
vouchers,
whatever. Yeah. But anything that they have to be paid back financially for the legacy. And again, it's in business. There's actual a legal standard
mm-hmm.
that you can be sued or have things taken away from you because of things that your grandparents or your parents did. Companies could be sued for things in civil actions.
Right.
It's a form of tort law that you could be sued for things that previous people did in a company 100 years previous right. before your time.
That's true.
So the federal government is a corporation that can be sued for things that it allowed and sanctioned through law that hindered the economic equality or equal opportunity of a whole legacy of people. So I'm vehemently against any conservative who tells me based on free enterprise that it's unjust for African Americans. And I wouldn't be able to access that because I'm from Liberia and I'm half Lebanese. Right. You know, so, but here's the issue. It was the radical Republicans who were for reparations, who put pressure on wow. Lincoln to, and they were motivated by faith.
Yeah.
And so I believe the Republican Party today, the moderates and the centrists are some of the most, it's all about money for them. Long as Trump brings more money and the free markets bring more money, wow. but they don't care about moral positions. And they've lied about abortion,
wow.
okay? Meaning these people are appointed to the Supreme Court, and they say they hold a certain position. But as soon as they get there, the pressure of the courts, the pressure of public opinion, and precedent, just like for 200-something years, the Supreme Court always established precedent for the institution of slavery, okay? And they reinforced it through law. And it's not going to change until men and women who are motivated by faith in God and theistic morality,
mm-hmm.
a morality driven by God,
right?
And because Republicans, the moderates that control a lot of the institutions, the establishment, does not care. It's all about power and money. And of course, the Democratic Party is, in a sense, the same kind of party that it was pre-civil rights.
Yep.
They could care less about the pre-born, this infant in the womb. It's not even an issue for them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just like they didn't care about the slave. It's all about money. And it's so wow. sad, man.
Wow. I wanted to add on to what you said about the respiration thing. I mean,
reparations.
Reparation.
Yeah.
You know, they did it with the Indians,
Jewish Holocaust.
Yes.
A lot of these groups.
Yeah, and my whole thing is, why not? You know, because I truly believe that a lot of our ancestors were brought here unwillingly. You know, nobody would get on the boat and say, hey, I just want to go. I'm going to go to the United States. You know, nobody did that. You know, and we didn't ask, and I always say that we didn't ask to come here, you know, but we're here, you know, and our ancestors, I know, didn't ask to come here. They were happy where they was at. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, you know, when I think of that, then like I heard Jack talk about the free labor. They got so much free labor off of us. I mean, they'll be owing us for years and years to come. So, I mean, what is wrong with that? When people say it, it's like, oh, you trying to get something from the government, you know, for something that happened years and years ago. I don't hear people say that too, you know. It's like, oh, that's petty. It's like you going back and you saying that this yeah. and that, this and that happened, and now you want to get some kind of money from that. Well, I'm still my granddaddy before he died, and his granddaddy before he died, and his granddaddy.
Yeah.
Before he died, was still waiting on they 40 acres and a mule.
The thing about it is,
and we never got it.
Yeah, the thing about it is, you bring up a very salient point. Important is that you gotta beg the question and ask, why is it that all these other groups got it? The Indians got the reservations, and mm-hmm. you can't mess with them. You know, the Jewish Holocaust.
Don't pay taxes.
And it's very interesting about the Jews, right? Check this out. The Jews will always remind their people about what happened to them, mm-hmm. so they don't repeat it. But when it comes to Africans and when it comes about slavery, oh no, listen, that happened 400 years ago. Don't worry about that. You know, a lot of conservatives and you know, a lot of evangelical conservatives will say, oh, you know, just I did it. You can do it. And so I think that the even if you look at the biblical part about restitution. The Bible is for it.
Yeah.
And if you look, I think that, and Jack and I talked about this before, I think this is the reparation is actually the one part that's missing,
mm-hmm.
Where you can actually try to, for healing.
Yeah.
I don't think you can't give out, money, you know, because it'll be like I don't know if you guys saw it, but it's pretty funny. It'll be like the Dave Chappelle skit. You saw that, right? It was like fried chicken, KFC went up at all-time high, Cadillac went up at all-time high. So I think you have to give it where the voucher that you give will be beneficial to not only your family but to the community.
Yeah, I think it should be land grants and an
education.
Lands or homes that you cannot sell for like 30, 40 years. So there's an opportunity for appreciation and also for a legacy to develop.
No money in the bank. No,
so yeah. I think it's like you said, land, education, or business voucher.
Yeah. Or business grant that can be applied towards business. But again, it's very liquid and very fluid, so it'd be hard to monitor. So I believe it needs to be something tangible like education or yeah. land or home grants. Wow. But here's the issue, right? The issue is this, that the abortion issue is just like the slavery issue. And that's what I'm submitting mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. It's the same issue. And the moderate Republicans are the same way about abortion as they were about slavery.
Wow.
They're complicit, they're apathetic, and the Democrat Party is the same way it was in defending and fighting for slavery.
Wow.
It's the same exact issue. Nothing's changed. And who are the people that are making all the noise in the Republican and the Democratic Party? It's people who are motivated by faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I give kudos to those blue dog conservative Democrats mm-hmm. that are fighting for social justice yeah. and a place for blacks to be at the table when yeah. it comes to public government and institutions and fighting discrimination. But what they're missing is the fight to stop the genocide of black babies. Now, according to this data here, let me bring it up here. Okay, I'm going to share my screen here so I can show it to the people who are viewing. National statistics, more than 19 million black babies have been aborted since 1973. Roe versus Wade, U.S. Supreme Court decision legalized abortion in our country. Black women have a significantly higher abortion rate than whites and Hispanics. 36.0% of all abortions in the U.S. in 2014 were performed by black women. However, only about 13.3% of the total population is black. African Americans are no longer the nation's largest minority group. Today, Hispanics have outpaced blacks in population growth. For every 1,000 live births, non-Hispanic black women had 391 abortions. Non-Hispanic white women had 120 abortions for 1,000 live births. So again, you know, you got Christians in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that are fighting for the dignity and equality mm-hmm. of people. But I believe that both are missing it, that it's not an either or. We need to fight for those who are alive, right, and living in our impoverished cities and communities, but we also need to fight for this Holocaust and this genocide that's happening to babies in the womb from all colors,
exactly,
but especially blacks. Because if you think about it, right, we're fighting for voting rights. We're fighting for economic power.
Right.
We're fighting for black families. But what do you do when your whole culture and people that look like you are being decimated and destroyed before they even get out the womb? Your population is decreasing.
Yeah. Right.
Right. You know, it's
decreasing, and you have to, you know, not only just abortion, but then just the societal messages that are
prison, and then the men are being locked up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the men are being locked up. You're pushing women to not want to get married and have children. So now you teach them, okay, go out and get your education, get yours, and now you're 30 years old. Now you're like, well, I've lived without a man.
Wow.
And then you have men who are being, you know, the hip hop community and just in general is pushing, no, don't get married, you know. So now you have people right. not having children, and then on top of that, the abortion rate. So it's slowly but surely causing us to decrease in population. And I think Jack brings up a good point. You know, the political realm is a three tier. You know what I call three tiers. You have spirituality,
right.
and you're based on your spirituality produces your morals, and based on your morals produces your political affiliation,
okay.
or your political ideology. And so a lot of people, their morality is based in money
mm-hmm.
and greed. So they don't care about you know, how this affects, you know, me. They just want to know how it affects my yeah. bottom dollar.
And look, the moderate Democrats put more emphasis on economic
mm-hmm.
conservatism, which is it's really about financial growth and stability of America. And
sure.
and they don't want to hear nothing from the social conservatives. You know, you find a lot of libertarians like that. Wow. It's all about economic growth, free market thought, free market money. You know, open trade. You know, it's all about the money, right?
Right.
And for them, morality is something you do in your church and your family. So, and the only thing that government should do is laws that don't hurt other people. But you do have libertarians that are against abortion because they believe it's a human being, like what's his name, Rand Paul.
Rand
you know,
Paul, yeah.
So long as you know and you believe that the infant is human, you would say that's wrong because they believe in a legislative
right,
in a legislative. A morality that affects legislation, long as it doesn't harm other people. The government's there to protect people. So the issue is, but I talk to a lot of Democrats, and everything is about justice and economic prosperity for those who are living. You know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And but what about the preborn? And since they can't see the preborn, you know, he's covered by flesh. God says he's alive. God says he has dignity. Their theology teaches that, but the battle is all about those who are alive. You know,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. blacks, Hispanics, intersectionality. You know, everyone that's a victim,
right.
that's alive. But in it is a form of kind of it's a form of greed in a sense that it's only about the tangible, capable human.
Right.
But what about the innocent? Then you got those on the other side who are basically, it's all about the infant. And they're not talking about real injustices that are happening towards those
right.
who are alive.
Right. Right.
And even though equal opportunity is espoused,
yeah.
it's denied in many ways.
It has to be a balance.
There has to be a balance. And I believe that balance can only really come from
right.
the body of Christ, from yeah. Christians who understand that Yahweh is concerned about all of these issues.
Yeah, the totality of it.
Totality. And he's not, you know, Yahweh's not just concerned about one thing. And so that kind of forces us to be independent, even within
yeah.
parties.
Yeah.
And just like the radical Republicans, I believe that the radical social conservative Republicans have to be the moral conscious of the Republican Party, and the radical Christians in the Democratic Party have to be that conscious within. And I don't believe everyone should be independent or escape from political parties. I believe
right.
we need people that love God who are engaged in political parties.
In those parties, to be able to infiltrate those parties and, you know, be effective in change. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
I had a conversation a couple of days ago with a Democrat, and she's a Democrat, and she's a Christian, you know, good lady. And she said, and she made a very important point. It talks about what Jack just said. She said, Republicans, how can you say you're pro-life when you're only concerned about the baby in the womb, but once this black baby is out, it doesn't matter. And I get what she was trying to say, is because a lot of conservatives, they're pro-life. Let's say, for an example, you know, it's particularly the white conservative evangelicals, you know, they'll stand with you on abortion, right? They'll stand with you on same-sex marriage. But when it comes to, like, a lot of the social injustices that we see, they don't want to talk about it. Or they automatically, they just try to disregard it and just say, preach the gospel. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're talking about preaching the gospel, the gospel is received vertically, and it's lived out horizontally, right. It's lived out communally.
Exactly.
So you cannot just say, oh, I'm pro-life in this aspect, but then you don't care about the baby or that child or that mother once that baby is born.
But I will say, you know, sometimes there's a false notion, right, that conservatives don't care about black people, and they do. But they care about them in the sense that they just don't believe that big government,
right,
is the solution. You know, they just believe in more of a grassroots, local,
the local level,
and that it needs to be indigenous. Yeah. I think a lot of conservatives believe, and there's truth to this, that there's nothing white people can do, I think, apart from, like, reparations and just fighting for equal opportunity,
right,
to help any culture, you know. Hispanics can't help white people, you know. Chinese can't help blacks and Puerto Ricans, like, because there is, and this is, they're in denial of this, okay. And you know, so as I studied cross-cultural dynamics, it's true. It's very, I mean, people can help. They can give you ideas.
Right.
They can give you capital. But what happens on a sustainable local level really has to come from indigenous groups. And Western missionaries understood this, even in the spread, right, of Christianity, that they had a hard time going to Africa, going to Latin America, going to Brazil, going to other parts of the world, and actually making the gospel, making Christianity relevant. It was only when the indigenous people,
right,
took Christianity and contextualized it. And that same principle applies to prosperity, applies to democracy, it applies to every form of universal truth. Right. And so conservatives are right in that sense, that
right,
and this is what Malcolm was trying to say. This is what the Nation of Islam was trying to say. I agree with them. I do believe in a form of nationalism, not a nationalism that's supremacist, right, black supremacist, right, white supremacist,
sure,
but it respects the dignity of other cultures, but a kind of nationalism where Middle Easterners say, we need to do something about the Middle East because no one else is going to fix it for us, and they can't.
Mm-hmm.
If whites get involved in the Middle East, then they'll be accused of being occupation imperialists, you know? And so you can't win. And that's kind of the reality of cross-cultural dynamics. You can assist, you can educate, you can mentor, but you cannot be the long-term gatekeeper,
right,
of the transformation of black community. Yeah. Only black leaders, and specifically black men,
yeah,
can change areas and rural and urban areas, yeah, like Oakland, Miami. I'm telling you, anything that happens here in the black community in South Florida is going to be because of black men, black clergy, black business leaders,
right,
black men especially, okay?
Yeah.
More so than black women, okay? Black women have been strong, powerful, pivotal forces in the black community.
It's going to come,
but change can't come and be sustained, okay, yeah, unless the black men take their God-given role to lead. The Bible says the head of every man is Christ and the head of every woman is man. So when it comes to leadership and strength and, mm-hmm, protection, I believe it has to be us,
yeah,
who basically, mm-hmm, take the responsibility to bring holistic, spiritual, economic, yeah, social change. And it's going to be done one day at a time, one month at a time, and one touch and transformation at a time.
I wanted to say this too. I've heard the saying. I had a gentleman tell me one time. He said, "The problem on that is that as black men and women, as black people in general, that you know our biggest problem is we don't know how to work together on you know our community, on you know our social issues in the community that we face every day." Even with our children.
Well, I'm going to say something that's going to really challenge us.
And he said to me, he said, that's the difference between white America. That was the difference between the Hispanics. That's the difference that's between, you know, all the other groups that come here. In the United States, that when they come ready to work together.
Reverend Reese, I'm going to say something that's going to blow you. It's going to so challenge you.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, okay, and this is careful analysis. And I mean, you know, me working and living in different cultures amongst whites, amongst Armenians, amongst Hispanics, mm-hmm. amongst Asians, amongst blacks, okay? Mm-hmm. I can say, I've studied culture, mm-hmm. okay? I would say the problem in the black community, especially impoverished black communities, is too much trying to do things together. Let me explain this to you.
Okay, now you got me.
Yeah, I got you intrigued. Look, check this out. White people don't think in terms of I need to find a white person to do business with. Mm-mm. I need to find a white bank. Okay? There's always racist in every culture. You know, less than 2% of whites ever owned slaves in America. Most mm-hmm. whites never had a slave in their whole entire life. They couldn't financially afford it. It was expensive, like buying a house. Okay, you know, and that slave produced money for you. It was return on investment. So, but very few people had that. Many whites themselves were poor. So here's the reality. Whites and Asians and Armenians and Middle Easterners and Nigerians, they don't come and think in terms of, I got to find a Nigerian to do business. You know what they do? They find the best deal.
Wow.
They're what I call they're competitive in the marketplace. The problem, and this is not all African Americans. I'll take you to Atlanta right now and show you a bunch of African Americans that don't think like poor African Americans in Oakland, in Watts, in Chicago, or Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those folk in the black capital of America, they're trying to do business, and they're in the marketplace to compete. And I'm gonna tell you something, white people, when you study post Civil War. White people have no problem doing business with black people. White people, Chinese people, people will go wherever there's a deal, wherever they can get value, wherever they can get. They'll go to black jazz club because black musicians are amazing. They'll go to black. Man, white people, if they stop buying hip hop out, I can give you so much evidence that white people will buy anything black
that
we produce.
Hey, their main principle is not race. It's about value and about how you adding like, what you're doing to me.
And so here's the issue. Black people, we need to stop thinking we need to work together. We need to start competing. We need to have grocery stores in Opa-locka, in Miami Gardens, that are Afrocentric, organic, raised in farms in the hood. Okay, this is organic branded, raised in the hood. Yeah. Like, and so they go in there. You got soul music, because you go into a Whole Foods, you go into a white little Trader Joe's, whatever. It doesn't matter. You're going there because of the deal. And I'm trying to tell you, if we have grocery stores, we have cafes. Mm-hmm. If we have realtors, you know, like, hey, buy a house with me. I'll not only find the best deal, but I'll give you tickets to Stevie Wonder concert. Wow. I'm just saying, it's all about the competition. And if we add our soul, we add our flavor to it. And I'm telling you, we need to stop saying we need to work together. We need to start saying we need to compete with each other to be the best so that we draw international commerce to us, whether it's banking, whether it's agriculture, whether it's our medical, and we need black lawyers to compete with one another and to provide services and products and stop thinking in terms of race. Compete with the Jewish people in Aventura. Compete with the Jewish people in Beverly Hills. Try to have a cafe that's better than Starbucks. You may not be able to compete with Starbucks volume, but you can make it more personal. You can make it more colorful. You can put in urban art. You can, you know what I'm saying? Like,
because right. it, yeah, think about it this way. Even if you look at it from a cultural standpoint, the Jewish mind, let's say for an example, you have a Jewish cafe in Aventura,
right.
And then another Jewish person comes in like right down the street. They're not going to look at each other and say, oh, he's being a coon.
Right.
Because he's trying to come in and service his good, and he's trying to come in and compete. What they're looking at it, oh, this is good competition. Oh, you trying to get one up on me? Bet. Let me show you what we're getting ready to do. They're going to go back and forth, and guess what happens? They actually bring more money to that community based on their competition.
Yeah, we need to get away from this idea of we need to do things together. Meaning, we do need to do things together, but we need to do things with all people and compete. We need, I believe, to basically encourage competition in our communities.
Right.
Not competition just with black people, black with blacks, but competition with the Asians, competition yeah. with humanity, not so that we can see them lose or live in poverty, okay?
Right.
But so that we can create better value at better prices, because that's ultimately how you become billionaires.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, man, this has been good. We're going to continue this conversation next week. We were going to talk a little bit about the whole rape issue with Brian Banks, but we just don't got time, man. We've really been flowing here today.
Yeah. Can I say sure. one thing on what y'all said? I like the competition, but, you know, I even think back in the day when we were fighting for civil rights, I don't know. I feel like sometimes that we don't have that same passion that we did. And I know you said it's not a racial issue, but why can't we work together still, but still on another level?
But this no, I'm saying you do. I mean, that here's the issue. Mm-hmm. You're naturally going to work with people that you culturally connect with.
That right. look like okay? you and you got the same
Koreans
values.
Do that. Filipinos mm-hmm. do that. Liberians do that. Everyone, that's a natural thing. But what's hurt the African-American community
mm-hmm.
is this sense that we're going to rise through the assistance of Anglos, Democrats, Republicans, political systems, and not us on the ground.
And black people didn't think like this prior to civil rights and Lyndon B. Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have older great aunts and grandparents. Listen, they had a sense of it was about business. It was about this. But yeah. then after that, then now we what they call the white daddy stepped in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, welfare, and then the assistance of the government stepped in. And then we lost our sense of competition. We lost our sense of what we valued in one another. And it was gimme, 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 right. gimme,
and,
gimme,
and
gimme.
And it's not competing with blacks with blacks. We just need to compete with the markets.
I mean, the markets.
The markets is, I mean, look what's happened to Opa-locka. The Latins are coming in and buying businesses, buying homes. All the warehouses are owned by Latins. And they're redeveloping. They're designing. And so the Latins, they're not competing with blacks. They're competing with the best communities. They're trying to develop, and right. and so we need to become international thinkers.
Right.
That's the problem I have with the modern day social justice movement, because it's limited in its scope, right. mm-hmm. and it doesn't take people out of poverty. What creates sustainable wealth is when you got people who have skills and innovation, and a fierceness and a competition to be better. What is better? Better service, better products, right. better medical clinics. Better education, better cafes, better restaurants, better churches, better services provided, better media outlets, better police departments.
Yeah.
Then what? Not against blacks, not against whites, but right. against the best in wherever you can find them. And that means we're going to China. We're learning manufacturing skills and distribution. We're learning we're learning the best from different cultures. We're learning finance and banking through Jewish community, and we're learning education and law through the best, Harvard, Yale. Mm-hmm. But our competition is with the best in society. So, Man, this has been a great time, and we're going to be back again next week, and we're looking forward to connecting with you guys. And thank you guys for joining the Jack and Kimian Show, and we pray for God's blessing upon your life, and we hope that you enjoy this podcast. Peace. Come in.
It took us so long to get here. And here really ain't that special. Was it all worth it? Was it all you hoped for and wished for? And I remember the daydreams of a preteen boy on grandmama's porch. Motley crew of ashy neat colored boys yelling, that's my car when an ice bus rolled by. Bathing in that summer afternoon sunset. Heads flat on the concrete, eyes straight into the sky as to drown out the smog and drug transactions we were obviously surrounded by. One day I'ma make it, but what is it? Objects? Things? And it's all to realize that calm, it really ain't that calm. And a struggle is much more enjoyable when the end ain't clutched. Like the moment you realize you're consumed with first world problems, I guess that means you made it. But it's eerie how uncomfortable it is when we get too comfortable. And when they're closing all the curtains to convince you that it's nighttime, don't believe them, don't believe them. And when they tell you it's a must have and you can't live without it, listen, you don't need it, you don't need it. And when they tell you sweet this and only this is beautiful, tell them I don't see it, I don't see it. Don't believe them, you don't need it, I don't see it.
It's
kind of like that notion that if you accept these set of notions, then your soul's premium is secure, right? And you searching for new mountains to climb as if you conquered the first one. You ain't done, you just comfy. And it seems like your soul's tenacity been done, moved to the suburbs, and them neatly aligned trees and perfectly manicured lawns, and them safe schools and parks is a good place to raise a beer belly, right? And them identical strip malls on every corner of your mind can feel a little claustrophobic, right? And it's there you realize that there is no there, cause this type of perfect, boy, it just ain't working. Don't you dare close them curtains, it ain't nighttime, you don't need another object. And that right there is not beauty. Homie, it's eerie how uncomfortable it is when we get too comfortable. But when they're closing all the curtains to convince you that it's nighttime, don't believe them, don't believe them. And when they tell you it's a must have, you can't live without it, listen.
They have a mutual benefit. Blacks will work together. Me and you will work together if we can do things that mutually benefit us.
Right.
And that's the nature of business. That's the nature of everything. It should be ministry. Two organizations are not going to work together unless of mutual benefit. And so that goes back to a business mindset. And that's what we need. We need more of a business mindset where people, and we need to stop thinking in terms of, and here's the reality. Obviously pastors shouldn't be competing with each other, but in a negative way. There's a positive competition, meaning, man, they're doing things well there. I want to learn and do things just as good or even better. You know, and that's the kind of competition I'm talking about. It's a collaborative competition. It's a competition that makes you better. And we should embrace that, because that's the fundamental difference between Westerners, like Anglos and like the early, like, I mean, not to say blacks don't have this. Blacks have this. Mm-hmm. But the early wave Cubans had that, and the second wave didn't. The second wave came in, they were all American criminals, man. And they were all communists, thinking they came here like, we want to get a check every month. And the older Cubans say that. They're the ones who came and bought everything and built all the hotels, and obviously they also brought a lot of drug money in and all that stuff. Yeah. But there was a sense of, we need business, we need capital.
Right.
And I believe that God, coupled with free market thinking, God family free market thinking, will take Opa-locka, Miami Gardens, Liberty City out of poverty. And I'm betting, basically my focus is, as God is kind of refocusing me, is to start working towards that. Spiritual, social, and economic restoration. I believe all, you know, God, it starts with people encountering God, then transforming the way they deal on that horizontal plane with their family, their spouse, and in the way they go about doing their business and their calling.
Exactly.
You know, like FLE has to have a strong business approach, or it'll die.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you got the God thing, you got the your marriage and your family thing, and what God, I believe, is trying to challenge you is on the whole economic thing.
Yeah.
To think creatively, to think innovatively, to have something that you are not only making money, but you're also helping, you're teaching and helping other people develop how to do that.
Exactly.
And that, see, and no one's going to talk to you like that. Very few people are going to come around you and be like, hey, Pastor Reese, you need to start thinking in terms of free market enterprise so you are not dependent on no one, not the government, not any grants. They give you grants, praise God. But there's a saying, you live by the grant, you die by the grant.
Yeah.
They'll cut you off.
No organization will make it long term by grants alone. You know what I'm saying? You got to develop business income streams where if the grant ends, you can keep going because you guys own property, you got rental income, and you guys have bought Subways. Look at the Mormons. You know how many businesses the Mormon church owns?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I was just saying, your building sitting. Getting ready to come up, saw these two Jewish guys, they're walking with plans, walking around your building, and he was talking to, I think he's the maintenance guy, because I seen him cleaning up the last time I came, and they was walking around with him.
I gotta call this guy real quick, sorry. But you guys keep talking.
Yeah, and I was watching these guys walking, Jewish guys walking around, and they had these plans, and they were looking at the building, and I guess they was...